your septic system.
Paracast with Gene Steinberg. The co-host is Chris O'Brien, and this week we have Jerry Clark. Now, Jerry Clark joined us before in eulogizing some dear departed UFO investigators, but now we have him all to himself. No eulogies necessary, although we might bring up some of those people in terms of his life experiences. Now, Jerry Clark has been a UFO investigator for longer than many people have been alive. How, Jerry, did you first become attracted to this issue, this phenomena?
Well, when I was young and impressionable, I read a book. And that book, as is true of so many in my generation, was Ed Ruppelt's The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, which was a memoir by the guy who headed Project Blue Book in the early 1950s. And it was a sensible, balanced book. And the first book I had read was a contactee book like George Adamski's. I don't think I would have been interested. Even as a kid, I would have thought that was nonsense. But Ruppelt got to the core of the mystery of this very interesting phenomenon, and I was hooked, and I guess I've stayed hooked.
Now, the Ruppelt book is kind of curious because he had the original version in 1956, as a matter of fact, and then there was a sequel or an update where he added several chapters and kind of poo-pooed the whole thing.
Well, kind of poo-pooed is putting it charitably.
Yes, indeed.
They were really strongly, virulently anti-UFO. I think that Ruppelt probably was always more skeptical than he indicated. I think that the first book, the first edition, the one published in 1956, may have been toned down not to put off an audience. At least Ruppelt claimed that. He lived only 4 more years after the publication of the first book, died in 1960 of a heart attack.
Now, I understand he was, what, in his late 30s at the time?
He was quite young, yeah. I don't think he'd reached 40. And he was not a terribly imaginative guy. According to Alan Hynek, whom I knew, Ruppelt was really kind of an organizer who had a good sense how to organize things, and he got the Air Force UFO project, which was in disarray in 1951 when he took charge of it, working again and conducting actual investigations. I think that Ruppelt probably wasn't daring or imaginative enough to take the leap that maybe these things represented some kind of otherworldly visitation, but he did acknowledge that some of the cases were really puzzling.
Now, if you believe Major Donald Kehoe, in one of his books, which was published ahead of the revision to the report on UFOs, he quoted Ruppelt as saying he was under pressure by his bosses to, or his former bosses at the time, to basically tear down UFOs, be more skeptical of it. What do you think of that?
Well, there's no question that the Air Force was not pleased with Ruppelt's book. It was far more open to the possibility that UFOs are real than the Air Force wanted. And in fact, a few years later, the later head of Project Blue Book just tore Ruppelt apart in a book that he wrote called Flying Saucers and the U.S. Air Force. So, yes, I'm sure that Ruppelt was under pressure, but I think that as we get from his biographer, Wendy Connors, and Michael Hall, Ruppelt was not really ever really a strong UFO proponent.
Do we think then maybe Kehoe was putting a spin on this? Was Kehoe that kind of person
who
put spins on
things? Well, there was certainly truth in that. It was obvious that the Air Force was unhappy. The Air Force was publicly unhappy with Ruppelt. And I think that the Air Force really wanted him to make a clear anti-UFO statement. In that sense, there was pressure, but I don't think that it was pressure to force Ruppelt to say something that he didn't believe on some level.
Okay, so in that sense, he basically gave you what his real viewpoint was, not something that was sugar-coated or forced upon him.
That's, I think, the most reasonable reading. I mean, I'm not reading his mind, but just from my understanding and from the biography of Ruppelt that Connors and Hall wrote, that this seems to be the most reasonable interpretation.
Okay, so you read the book, Report on UFOs, a pretty straightforward presentation. Now, you're a young guy. Where do you go from there to pursue your interest?
Well, I subscribed to Fate magazine in about 1960, 1961, which introduced me to the kind of subculture of UFO buffs. In those days, as you remember well, Gene, there were the subculture specifically of teenage UFO buffs. And they published teenage UFO publications and teenage UFO organizations. I don't think anything like that exists anymore. But there was a thriving scene. In fact, my friend David Halperin, just next month, is coming out with a book, a novel, based on his experience as a teenage UFO buff.
I wonder what he'll say about me.
Well, I'm waiting for my copy of the book. It's called, I think it's called Journal of a UFO Investigator or something like that. And it's supposed to be pretty good. But anyway, then I began to get books through interlibrary loan, which introduced me to the books of Charles Fort, which probably in the long span of things proved to be a greater influence on me even than Ruppelt was. Because Fort had a larger kind of view of anomalies generally and really put sightings of UFO-like objects into the broad context of other kinds of unexplained phenomena that also interested me, not so much psychic phenomena, but things like falls from the sky, cryptozoological animals, and that sort of thing.
Did you at all feel at that point that UFOs and the rest of these things were related or what?
They were related in being puzzling, hard to explain. You know, it wasn't easy to particularly see a connection between a report of a lake monster and a report of a UFO, and I still don't really see that connection. But it was just interesting to be open to a world of strange things. Made the world seem much more lively and engaging than the little life I was living in a small town in Minnesota.
Now, at the time you and I got together, at that point you did have more of a paranormal slant to the UFO mystery. How did that take place? How did that reflect itself?
I don't think that's true, Gene. I remember I pretty much thought like Donald Keogh, except that I was also interested in other stuff. But where UFOs are concerned, I thought and continue to think that the core phenomenon is probably extraterrestrial in origin. And I think if you go back to Keogh's books, which were published mostly in the 1950s, they concentrated on the kinds of sightings that pilots and Air Force officers and police men and people like that were making. So sort of these solid reports of daylight discs that showed up on radar. And that is still the core of the UFO phenomenon. And that's what Keogh was interested in. And Keogh was also an avid reader of popular astronomy. So he was connecting these reports with the state-of-the-art scientific speculation about life on other planets. And even in the 1950s, many astronomers thought that there could be intelligent life on Mars and even Venus.
Sure, that's one thing, too. Keogh, in his books, was speculating on the possibility of Mars, Martian UFOs, the canals, all that stuff, things that we learned later were not quite that way. Even the early contactees, you know, the space beings
right.
They met came from Venus or Mars. But, of course, we didn't know that Venus was a hothouse, so those individuals would have to live in a pretty strange climate. But we understand that he was just basically mirroring what he was reading at the time.
Well, even Donald Menzel, who was the major UFO skeptic at the time and a Harvard University astronomer, believed that that Venus consisted of a gigantic ocean with mermaid-like beings in it. So even, you know, straight UFO skeptical scientists had some pretty extreme and exotic ideas about neighboring planets.
Now that was Donald Menzel thought that?
Yeah.
That's news to me. Wow.
Yeah.
Figure.
Yeah, isn't that strange? It's really ironic. To me, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I also love those crazy pictures that he drew that Jim Moseley bought, those paintings of space beings.
Yeah. Yeah, those were kind of out of his imagination, as were the mermaids of Venus, but he did propose that.
Mermaids from Venus, I don't know if I can handle that. The inspiration for the movie Splash, I don't think so. Jerome Clark joins us, UFO historian. Our co-host is Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Are you ready to order the official Paracast t-shirt? You asked, we answered. We're now taking orders for the official Paracast t-shirt. It comes in white, 100% cotton. The front of it features the same logo that we have on our community forums. On the back it says, Separating Signal from Noise. To order the official Paracast t-shirt, here's all you have to do. Visit our new online store at store.theparacast.com. One more time, that's store.theparacast.com. You can use a major credit card to place your order for the official Paracast t-shirt. Hey neighbors, we have one more thing to talk about, and that's more merchandise at the official Paracast store. We have hats, we have jackets, we even have a flip video camcorder customized with the Paracast logo at the official Paracast store. It's all now available at the official Paracast store, store.theparacast.com.
Are you wondering about your retirement portfolio? Are you confident that the financial advisor is experienced enough to combat climbing interest rates, taxes, and inflation? Stop guessing and go to the expert, Robert Chapman of the International Forecaster. When you subscribe to the International Forecaster, you get Robert Chapman's 45 years of experience and concise investment recommendations. Who needs sugar-coated excuses when you can get the cold hard facts and proven investment leads you can't get anywhere else? For a free introductory copy to Robert Chapman's International Forecaster, subscribe now at theinternationalforecaster.com or call 877-479-8178. Experience the difference. When you subscribe, you can email Robert Chapman directly to obtain investment advice tailored just for you. Don't wait another minute. Subscribe today at theinternationalforecaster.com or call 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178.
Becoming a modern smoker is now easier and more cost-effective, thanks to LeCig. Traditional smokers the world over love LeCig. E-cigarettes with a look, feel, and taste of real cigarettes, but without the nasty smoke, ashes, or stains. LeCig is powered by revolutionary microelectronic technology. A small, rechargeable battery and unique replaceable cartridge provide all the satisfaction and benefits of smoking without the smoke and all the hazards. See the large variety of LeCig e-cigarette supplies and accessories at LeCig.com. That's LeCig.com. LeCig is competitively priced, comes with the best customer service, a 30-day warranty, and satisfaction guaranteed. What a great gift idea. For a 10% discount, mention GCN when you call 870-518-4307. That's 870-518-4307. Ask for fast, free, same-day shipping. Order online at LeCig.com and use promo code GCN at checkout. That's LeCig.com. LeCig, for today's modern smoker.
Did you know that drinking pure, high alkaline water is one of the most important factors in maintaining high energy and vibrant health? Most experts agree that the water you drink should be at a pH level of 8 or higher. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops, available only at AlkaVision.com, combine a unique formula of only the most alkaline minerals. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops alkalize your water, ridding the body of harmful toxins, and helps you regain health and energy. Alkalizing your water by simply adding 10 drops of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops helps the body rid itself of acidic waste, increases oxygen content, and raises the pH of your body to healthy levels. And bacteria and viruses cannot survive in an alkaline high pH environment. Order your bottle of AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops for only $29.95 at AlkaVision.com. That's AlkaVision.com. Or call 269-409-1776. 269-409-1776. Alkalize your body. Supercharge your health at AlkaVision.com today.
On air, online, and on demand, we are the GCN Radio Network.
We want to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com. Get in on all the action at forum.theparacast.com.
Jerry Clark joining us. Chris O'Brien's the co-host. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in the PowerCast. Now, if we believe certain documents that came to light in the 1980s, the so-called MJ-12 documents, and of course we're going to want to hear your viewpoint about that, Donald Menzel, of course, having worked allegedly in intelligence in World War II, was still basically presenting this side of himself as the UFO skeptic. That was a pose. He was part of MJ-12. Is that all a big, colossal joke?
Well, I think the allegation is, in fact, I think that whoever forged the MJ-12 document put that in as a conscious joke, never realizing that somebody, we're talking here about Stan Friedman, would run with it. And I don't believe for a second that Menzel was anything other than a man who was deeply skeptical of UFO reports, almost fanatically so.
I saw him on a TV show called Open Minds in the 1960s. He was on with a couple of UFO authors, and the man went almost apoplectic. He had a near-nervous breakdown screaming about UFOs and they're not being real.
Yes. According to Alan Hynek, who knew Menzel well as an astronomical colleague, Menzel was really a highly overbearing sort of individual who couldn't stand to lose or to be disagreed with. And his behavior on UFO matters was pretty consistent with his character. And he was really a fanatic who would go to any length to disprove a UFO report, even if he had to make stuff up. Menzel was not a good guy in the sense of making it possible for scientists to examine UFO data. If any one scientist could be said to have killed scientific curiosity about UFOs, it's Menzel.
Now, after that, of course, we had Phil Klass. Maybe more personable, but still the same attitude.
Klass, of course, wasn't a scientist, and he had no scientific credentials. His education was in engineering. And he was not really scientifically sophisticated in the way that Menzel was. For example, Philip Klass's first book, UFOs Identified, where he proposes this idea of giant plasmas as the cause of UFO reports, was ridiculed even in the Condon Report, which was otherwise skeptical of UFOs, and was essentially treated as a work of pseudoscience. And after that, after the drubbing he took, Klass moved from thinking that UFOs actually had an anomalous origin, and giant plasma certainly would have been anomalous. He went on to a more traditional debunking posture where UFOs are hoaxes or mistakes, and the people who claim otherwise are shady characters. And since a lot of people, since elite opinion wanted to hear that, Klass had quite a successful career until his death as a UFO debunker.
He was the guy that the TV talk shows, they need to have a fair and balanced presentation, so you bring on a skeptic like a Phil Klass, because then you can bring on the believer and say you're being fair to both sides.
Right. Yeah, Klass was an important figure in the culture and in the discussion about UFOs, but he wasn't Menzel. Menzel really played a very special role. And I can understand why somebody would think that, well, maybe he was really up to something other than what he appeared to be up to, which was a sincere rejection of the UFO phenomenon. But what we saw of Menzel as a UFO debunker was, from all accounts, entirely consistent with his personality.
Any possibility he was put up to doing that by the authorities and the government, or he just did it on his own accord?
Well, Project Blue Book under Ruppelt, and Ruppelt headed Blue Book from late 1951 till early to mid-1954, thought that Menzel's explanations were nonsensical, and this was opinion widely shared within the Air Force UFO Project and those other military people who had some association with it. And they rejected Menzel's effort to take their reports and explain them for them. And Menzel made this offer. Menzel was disliked. He was considered not an honest man, and his explanations were rejected by the Blue Book scientists. But after Ruppelt left and Blue Book became the public relations debunking operation that it was until it closed in 1969, the Air Force was working with Menzel. They decided that their quarrel with Menzel was much less than any quarrel they had with UFO proponents. And so Menzel was given access to Air Force UFO reports, and his explanations were, you know, were accepted.
Anything to basically pour cold water on the whole thing.
Right. Yeah. It was just the idea seemed to be that since UFOs are nonsense, any explanation, even if it isn't strictly true, will do.
But that takes us to what's going on the other side. Major Kehoe speaks of a silence group, a group of people, individuals within the government who are covering up UFOs. So do you think there was ever such an organization, or they just wanted to wash their hands of the entire affair?
Well, I don't really know. This is something, of course, that everybody wonders about. And there are, you know, there's some circumstantial evidence that there was a group that took UFO sightings more seriously than the Project Blue Book seemed to be doing. And I just don't know. It's hard for me to believe that you could have really puzzling reports, radar visual reports, sightings by pilots and Air Force people and military personnel of clearly structured, you know, machine-looking objects performing, you know, extraordinarily and defying interceptions from our aircraft, and not think that there was something of national security implication going on. And so I don't think it's unreasonable to think that there was some group that at least very closely monitored sightings in sensitive places like military bases and the atomic installations and so on. But it's very hard to prove that there was any such group, and if there was, what conclusions it came to. The most interesting speculation in this regard is in Leslie Keene's recent book, where she finds a document of undeniable provenance that suggests that within the government there is a kind of small off-the-books agency which meets periodically to study really puzzling UFO reports with national security implications and takes them seriously, but that you could never find if you looked through a list of government agencies.
So this is something that's off the books in many ways. Of course, doing things off the books, I guess that's normal for the U.S. government, wasn't it? Rumsfeld, who was talking about, what, $2.2 trillion of money that had not been accounted for?
Well, there's a lot of that that's going on. There's no question that there's off-the-books stuff going on in the government, and that's probably where you would find the so-called silence group.
But how active
it is, it may be more passive in having an analytical function rather than a function going around and threatening UFO witnesses.
And a reminder, if you want to get involved and participate in our discussions, join our forums, forum.powercast.com. That's forum.powercast.com. All you have to do to sign up is give yourself a unique username, such as the greatest UFO fan in the world. No, I think that's taken. Check it out, forum.powercast.com. We'll get back with more with Jerome Clark. Our co-host is Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Ray Perkins, a reclusive veteran burned out from the Gulf War, lives tortured by relentless, perplexing nightmares. Nightmares of a horrific battle in deep space and of a mysterious woman suffering in agony for her devastated world. A woman not yet born, calling across centuries to him. Then, a coincidence leads him to his destiny, his chance to alter the universe. Attack! Of the Rockoids. The former fiction editor for Star Wars and Indiana Jones, Robert Simpson, writes, "The soul of the novel Attack of the Rockoids lies in its heart and passion for building a convincing tale of a love that spans a galaxy. A thrilling story. Attack of the Rockoids is available now. Read a sample chapter and get a special discount off of the cover price at our website, rockoids.com. That's rockoids.com. Attack of the Rockoids, a novel in the grand science fiction tradition."
This message starts with a great offer from Big Berkey Water Filters, because we don't want you drinking dangerous water 1 minute longer. Right now, purchase any filter system from BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com to get your choice of two Berkey Sport bottles, a KDF shower filter, a set of fluoride filters, or our new sight glass spigot absolutely free. Why do this? Because over 60% of municipal water is fluoridated, and at less than 2 cents per gallon, Berkey Water Filters purify both treated and untreated water, removing dangerous chlorine, fluoride, and other contaminants. Big Berkey water filters are powerful enough to purify stagnant pond water, so they're perfect for rainwater collection systems and emergency preparedness. Remember, Big Berkey includes free shipping on every order over $50. And GCN listeners get 5% off all ceramic filter systems. Visit BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com or call 877-99-BERKEY. That's BigBerkeyWaterFilters.com or call today 1-877-99-BERKEY.
Hi, I'm Mark Craighead, founder of Crossbreed Holsters. I designed our top-selling holster, the Super Tuck Deluxe, to solve the problems of being poked, pinched, and gouged while carrying concealed. The Super Tuck Deluxe is the most comfortable, most concealable holster on the market today. We offer a 2-week free trial and a lifetime warranty.
Visit us at crossbreedholsters.com. Don't forget, crossbreedholsters.com.
If you're serious about playing college football, give yourself the competitive edge with the National Underclassmen Football Combine. The NUC is the longest-running underclassmen event and the most respected combine and football camp in the nation, specifically designed to give athletes early recruiting exposure. There's no better time than now to compete in the National Underclassmen Football Combine. Call 888-NUC-MVP1 or go to nationalunderclassmen.com to find out more.
This is Alex Jones with 5 good reasons you should consider buying a solar power generator. Number 1, new climate legislation could easily double or triple your electric bill. Number 2, our new energy czar wants to control how much power your electric company allows you to have. It's true. Total government control of electricity in the name of smart grid technology is coming. Number 3, in some areas of the country, the power grid is dangerously overloaded. And now, new socialist legislation is only compounding the problem. Number 4, dangerous weather is always a threat to local grids. Every year, thousands of families lose their power from weather-related outages. Number 5, a solar power generator provides powerful backup, insurance, and peace of mind. Folks, I really believe in the solar power generators offered by Solutions from Science, one of my oldest sponsors. You can get more information at www.mysolarbackup.com. That's mysolarbackup.com. Remember, the government doesn't own the sun, so go to mysolarbackup.com or call 1-877-327-0365.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
This is Jim Mosley, editor of Saucer Smear, and I'm here to say a good word or two about the Paracast, which I believe is the gold standard of paranormal radio. Listen to it if you can.
We're back with Jerome Clark, UFO historian. Chris O'Brien's the co-host. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in the Paracast. Chris, would you pursue the questioning?
Yeah, Jerry, I'm very intrigued by a new book that Nick Redfern just had published a couple of months back called Final Events. And in that book, he mentions a group that's been dubbed the Collins Elite, I guess for convenience, that has been fairly active, but low-key and behind the scenes, looking into the UFO phenomenon, and they determine that it's something of a demonic nature, that we're not really dealing with extraterrestrials as much as we're dealing with demons. Are you aware of this book, number one? And number two, what do you think of that pretty interesting take on this whole thing?
I have the book. I haven't read it yet. I do read most of Nick's books, and I respect him. He's a conscientious, hardworking guy. And I don't say that in any condescending way, because I don't want to give you the impression that when I say what I'm about to say, I'm putting it off on Nick. If that's what he's found, I'll read what he's found. But no, I certainly don't believe UFOs are demonic. And you have to remember that even within the United States government, you know, there are some very, very, you know, religious people with really kind of fundamentalist views. And that's where that sort of thing would show up, where, you know, a kind of fundamentalist theology would intersect with anomalies. And they always conclude that they're demonic. That just seems to be the de facto conclusion. No, I certainly don't take that theory seriously, if theory is even the word for it.
Well, it's some of the information that he puts in there is pretty interesting, and it does make you wonder how people can when they're. I think it's human nature when you're faced with something unknown, you tend to revert to basic primal thinking. I think.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's I do recommend that book for people that are looking for interesting out of the box theories on the phenomenon, but. Where do you see the involvement in the government in, let's say, in behind the scenes in let's say UFO groups monitoring the actual cultural side of this as opposed to the science and the actual reports and what have you? Obviously, during the Cold War, the government was probably interested in UFO groups because of the possible infiltration by Eastern Bloc countries. But do you see the government having a very active role, let's say, in the demise of NICAP or in some of the interesting scenarios that have played out over the years?
Well, I think that NICAP was probably the only group in UFO history that actually posed something of a threat to official UFO policy. Because NICAP had all these, you know, retired admirals and generals and, you know, high-ranked former CIA people and so on its board of governors. And it was located in Washington. Donald Keogh, who was the head of NICAP, had all kinds of, you know, official contacts within the government and within Congress because of his long history at the Pentagon desk office. So the Air Force really did not like NICAP. But when I was working on my encyclopedia during the 1990s, I got access to the NICAP files. And I was particularly interested in the documents relating to NICAP's demise. According to a widespread legend, the CIA infiltrated NICAP and destroyed it. The documents, the internal documents, do not provide any evidence for that conclusion. What happened was basically Keogh mismanaged the organization. Keogh did not have managerial skills, did not know how to handle money, and there were all kinds of problems. And at one point, J.B. Hartranft, who was a member of the board and who was the head of the, I can't remember exactly the name of it, but it was like the Private Pilots Association of America. That's not exactly it, but close enough. And Hartranft was a wealthy guy, like a lot of these guys were. And he began going through the NICAP rules and discovered that if the organization collapsed, he and his rich buddies were going to be financially responsible. And Hartranft just about went ballistic. And when he learned that when NICAP fell apart, it was going to cost him a lot of money, he began organizing the board and telling them they had to get rid of Keogh. And that's what happened. It's just sort of a, you know, has to do more with economics of government secrecy. And they put somebody in charge who had some kind of CIA background, which probably wasn't that unusual in Washington at that time. A guy didn't know a lot about UFOs, but who had some organizational skills and wasn't going to drive the organization to the ground and cost these guys on the board a lot of their own money. And that's basically the story of NICAP's collapse. I know that this legend about the CIA collapsing organization, I simply didn't find any evidence for it.
Now, during a lot of those years, Richard Hall was the day-to-day manager of NICAP. I mean, I visited them a couple of times in the 60s, and Keogh wasn't there. He was seldom there. He'd come in maybe once or twice a week. So Hall did the day-to-day work. So do we blame the late Richard Hall for some of NICAP's lapses at the time?
In the documents that I saw, Hall's name didn't come up. It was Keogh's name. Keogh was the guy who was causing all the alarm and generating the criticism. Dick Hall was, I think, probably more competent in that way than Keogh was. And I think that to the extent that NICAP was effective on a day-to-day basis, and it was remarkably effective in a lot of ways, the investigations, the field investigations that NICAP conducted are just marvels. They're models of how UFO investigations should be conducted. And you can't really appreciate that unless you actually see those files and read what's in them. in some of the cases that I discuss in my UFO encyclopedia, they're based almost entirely on the NICAP field investigations, which were so thorough that it was just astonishing. Now, Kehoe wasn't participating in these, but Dick Hall was overseeing this and interacting with the heads of the various subcommittees that were conducting the field investigations. So I think Dick Hall is one of the unheralded heroes of the story and of ufology generally.
Well, I know that I had some run-ins with Richard Hall at the time because he could be kind of an irascible person.
Yes, he was. He was a good friend of mine, but yes, he was irascible. And sometimes I was at the receiving end of that, even as his good friend.
Okay, so we look at NICAP then, therefore, we can't say that NICAP, even though it was heavily laden on his board with former military officers, that it was really a front. Because that was one of the other theories about NICAP at the time, that NICAP was a front for the CIA or some other organization designed to, again, mislead people about UFOs or point them in the wrong direction. But what you saw didn't indicate that. Do you think that maybe there were certain documents that were withheld from you when you checked this?
It didn't look like that to me. There was a pretty clear paper trail. Also, the kinds of people that were on the NICAP board were the kinds of people that Donald Kehoe knew. They were his natural friends, the kinds of people that he socialized with, you know, conservative military people. And that describes Kehoe, retired military people. These were his pals. It wasn't that they came out of the woodwork and forced themselves on him. These are people, for the most part, he knew pretty well.
The people he most felt that he trusted that would be willing to go out on the limb and admit that there's a possibility that UFOs existed. It all sounded pretty good, although I got the impression, too, at the time as a member of NICAP, I was a member of NICAP at the time, a card-carrying member. They could never get their newsletter out on time. Kehoe was always putting this public appeals, we need donations, we need financing. So it is possible it's not just mismanagement then, that maybe they just couldn't get enough money to keep it going properly. We'll get into more of that in a moment. UFO historian Jerry Clark joining us. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Is there a secret UFO agenda? Do strange creatures from the darkest corners of the mind roam the earth? Is there evidence for mind control, time travel, or devious government conspiracies? Find out the inside scoop on the latest conspiracies, paranormal activity, and Freudian phenomena when you subscribe to Tim Beckley's Conspiracy Journal. It's jam-packed with stories, special book and DVD promotions, and the best news, it's absolutely free, sent right to your mailbox. Plus, a bonus free email newsletter sent out every Friday. Simply send an email with your name and address to MrUFO@webtv.net. That's MrUFO@webtv.net. Find out what they don't want you to know.
All types of batteries for all types of gadgets. We'll say it again. All types of batteries for all types of gadgets. Electronics, toys, flashlights, computers, accessories, and more are at BatteryStation.com. Whatever type battery you need, alkaline, lithium, gel cell, NiCad, metal hydride, sealed lead acid, and more are at BatteryStation.com. Our homepage gives you quick access to ham, marine, police, fire, and aviation batteries. Plus, choose from our great selection of LED flashlights with no bulb to ever burn out and much longer battery life. Find many top brands, including Streamlight, Pelican, Surefire, Novatek, Gerber, and more at BatteryStation.com. You'll also find the most popular brands of ammunition and watertight cases for storing guns, food, electronics, survival gear, and more at BatteryStation.com. Call 417-257-7799. That's 417-257-7799. You will be surprised when you visit BatteryStation.com.
In a coming-apart world, you need something to keep it tied together. That something is Atwood Rope, the highest quality rope made in the USA from exotic braids for military, rescue, arborists, shipyards, tow line, or boating. Quality rope at affordable prices you and your customers can depend on. Find a dealer or shop online at atwoodrope.net. Enter promo code RADIO to receive 100 feet of 550 paracord free with purchase. Atwood Rope, working to keep the world tied together.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.
Men, take control of your prostate health without the risk of nasty side effects with Prostate Secure. Early detection, regular prostate exams, and PSA tests are a must for men over 40. Listen, if you have symptoms of an enlarged prostate but don't want to take a drug with possible nasty side effects, or if you're over 40, then use Prostate Secure, a natural dietary supplement for men. Prostate Secure is a scientifically formulated blend of clinically significant amounts of natural ingredients. It brings together the most powerful plant sterols like beta-cytosterol and saw palmetto, along with antioxidants such as vitamin D3, resveratrol, and lycopene to support good prostate health, proper urinary flow, function, and more. Check out ProstateSecure.com. Order online and save 10% with promo code SAVE10 or call 1-800-239-9432. That's 800-239-9432. Or visit ProstateSecure.com. Take control of your prostate health naturally with Prostate Secure.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
This is the Paracast. You never know what's going to happen next.
We return with Jerome Clark. The book he's talking about is this UFO history book. Tell us more about it before we go into more details about NICAP and other organizations.
Well, during the 1990s, I did a multi-volume UFO encyclopedia for the reference house Omnigraphics. And that multi-volume series, which actually was in two editions, the second of which was, which is the definitive one, was published in 1998, is really the fullest history of the UFO controversy that has seen print anywhere. And I spent years working on it and had access to all kinds of materials that hadn't seen print before. So it's a perspective that's based on a lot of original research and primary documents and interviews and so on. So there's a lot of things in there that people don't know or that correct or extend the record. And, you know, it's really kind of my life's work. My most recent book, which came out in this summer, is called Hidden Realms, Lost Civilizations and Beings from Other Worlds, is an overview of the wilder side of everything, the Shaver mystery and things like that.
Let's briefly segue to the wilder side, the wild woolly side of UFOs, the Shaver mystery, stuff like that. Now, obviously, there are attractions to the kind of things that Shaver talked about, and you and I both knew Shaver, so we have some personal knowledge of this. But are there things we should mention about people like Shaver, maybe in connection with that Ray Palmer, that would illuminate more their point of view or why they came to those conclusions?
I want to say one thing. I did not know Shaver personally, unlike you. And I want to also say that the interview that you did with Shaver that you published years ago is probably the single most illuminating interview with the man that I've ever read, and I've often had occasion to go back to it and cite it.
I'm surprised. Thank you. This was published like in the early 1970s, where my first wife, Geneva, and I took a drive out to some place in rural Arkansas, found this cottage with Richard Shaver and his wife Dorothy, personable people. And the thing I liked about him is I had a brief interview and I said, you know, anything you want to add? And he says, no, I just want to go get a cigarette.
Well, I found that incredibly illuminating interview. Maybe you just happened to ask in that brief time all the right questions, and Shaver was being unusually frank.
What are the things that we take away from Richard Shaver about his contribution or lack thereof to UFO research?
I don't think he made any contribution to UFO research, but I think that he made a contribution to the kind of folklore and culture of the otherworldly. And I think that there's another kind of distinction seldom remarked on that really needs to be stressed. Most people who talk about visionary experiences are kind of visionary scenarios of a larger, stranger, other world are perfectly sincere and mentally well. You know, in contrast to the standard that, well, if you think that or claim that this happened to you, you experienced that, you must be a nut. Well, actually, there's a fair amount of, scholarly and psychiatric writing on the subject, and people who have otherworldly visions aren't necessarily mentally ill. In fact, there's some evidence that actually some of them are better off than the rest of us. But I do believe that Shaver's visions grew out of clinical mental illness and that he did spend a lot of time in mental institutions. And I think that if Shaver hadn't connected with Ray Palmer, who, as you know, was an incredible promoter of all kinds of outlandish things, we wouldn't be talking about Shaver. It had just been another crazy person.
Well, Palmer said in the interview I did with him, he revealed, you know, Shaver was in a mental institution. And, of course, Shaver became very incensed over this. But the point being that Palmer knew what to say and how to say it. Do we believe Palmer? Palmer claimed he was at one point harassed by alleged men in black or under-earth beings or something like that.
Well, Palmer tells one story which he stuck with over the years, and that was that when he first went out to visit Shaver in Pennsylvania, which would have been probably in early 1945. He doesn't date this, but that's as near as I can trace it. He claims that he heard voices talking about torturing a young woman, and of course the demonic entities that Shaver talked about were really basically sadistic idiots called Duros. And so Palmer claimed that he heard all these voices while he was in the bedroom late at night at the Shaver residence, and he said that it was impossible for Shaver to have faked all these voices. And Palmer carried this story forward for years, and he was repeating it even close to the end of his life. And this was the source for his alleged belief that there was something to what Shaver was saying. The problem is, I worked, as you know, for many years for Fate magazine, and I knew Kurt and Mary Fuller very well, and they had co-founded Fate with Palmer, and they knew him years before because they both worked for Ziff Davis Publishing in Chicago. And I often asked them about Palmer and Shaver and so on. And they said that although they thought that Shaver was really a personable guy, they thought that he was like a mental case, literally, you know, not figuratively. And they also said consistently about Palmer that it was just simply impossible ever to tell what Palmer believed about anything. And so that anything that Shaver, that Palmer said, they tended to view, shall we say, cautiously.
So basically, was Palmer just making up a lot of these things just to sell magazines? Is that also a problem they had in relating with him? Is that why he split from the Fullers? What's the answer?
That was one reason. They had trouble. In the early years of Fate magazine, Mary Fuller suffered from tuberculosis, and the Fullers had these small children. And Kurt Fuller was also the editor of Flying magazine. So Kurt was extremely busy raising these small children, working as an editor, and taking care of his wife. So the magazine in the early years was run almost exclusively by Palmer. So there's all kinds of content in those early years, some of which actually still survives in fringe literature, that may actually have been Palmer-written fiction. And the Fullers tell me that they could never really tell because the records were scarce, and they couldn't believe what Palmer told them. So as you read those wonderful early issues of Fate, there wasn't really any control over the factual content. So Palmer, I think, you know, human beings are complicated. You can't just summarize a whole life or a whole personality in a single sentence, unless you're dealing with some extremely dull individual. But Palmer, I think, was even more complex than most people. And that there were things, I think, I suspect, that he genuinely believed. But whether he believed them or not, they were all subject for exploitation. And it didn't matter whether he found it credible or not. If he could exploit it and make money.
P.T. Palmer.
he was like a carnival barker. That's who I compare him to.
P.T. Barnum.
Yeah.
Some people talk of Gray Barker in that fashion.
Oh, Gray Barker's idol was Ray Palmer.
Yes, we know that, yeah.
I assume you guys have seen that excellent documentary film, Shades of Gray, done about Barker's life.
Yes, we did an episode about it, and I did get to see it briefly, and of course I knew Barker as you did. So it was interesting what his approach was, but, you know, some of us, like Alan Greenfield, always believe that in the end, Gray Barker had this kernel of belief in UFOs, but ever the showman, he basically focused on the stuff that sounded good, that could potentially sell books, sell magazines, not so much on the hardcore research where he wasn't so concerned.
Absolutely. I think, in fact, in the film, I say something in the same. That, yeah, it's not hard to be puzzled by UFOs, to think that there's really something strange and unknown going on here. But, you know, at some point you begin to realize, you know, there's not much I can do about it. You know, and some people just beat their heads forever, like me and you guys, and other people just think, hey, I'm going to have fun with it.
So you know, that might be part of the problem, though, in some of the things that are written or broadcast about UFOs, is people concentrate on the possibility of taking something like this and say, hey, you know, we can have fun, we can make money, we can really have a good time, and it doesn't so much matter what the UFOs are, what their impact on our civilization might be. We're very much impacted over the years by Jerome Clark, UFO historian. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
The Paracast.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. If you own an Apple iPhone and love to listen to your favorite programs on GCN, I've got good news for you. I'm proud to announce that GCN has a brand new iPhone app available for our dedicated listeners at GCNlive.com. Listen to your favorite hard-hitting GCN programs live or on demand right on your iPhone. And the best part? The GCN iPhone app can be yours absolutely free. Download the iPhone app today by clicking on the banner at GCNlive.com. Again, that's GCNlive.com.
Hi. Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.